Hello, welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, biologist and author Olivia Judson tells us where science is missing out in its quest for knowledge and why we should experiment. Plus,
what you are going to suggest to us may be very surprising and strange and unexpected, but we won't believe it unless you have motivating evidence for it.
Particle physicist turned theologian John Polkinghorne talks to us about how he quantifies his religious beliefs. And why doodling while you listen to this podcast shows you are paying attention. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello everyone, I hope you're sitting or standing comfortably. In the pod with me this week to chew over the science world are Guardian's science correspondents James Randerson and Ian Sample. Hello both.
Hello.
Hi there, I'm doodling under the table.
Well done, Ian, you sound suitably happy and impressed. Weren't you make you waylaid by Gordon Brown this morning? What happened to you?
I decided not to go and see him, actually.
You decided not to go to see the Prime Minister?
I found out what he was going to say. It's mildly interesting.
So you decided not to go see the Prime Minister and instead record this podcast.
Exactly.
I think that's commitment. That's very good. It's very good. Our guest today is Olivia Judson, who is an evolutionary biologist and the author of the marvellous Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. On Tuesday, she's going to give the Sense About Science annual lecture, sponsored by The Guardian. She'll be talking about the limits of knowledge in the context of scientific experiments. Olivia, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you wrote a piece for us on Comment is Free a few days ago, which has sort of been getting some interesting comments and things. Now, in that, one of the things you talk about is why it's okay to look ridiculous when you're doing science. Can you just tell us why it's okay to do that?
Well, I think that a lot of science is about curiosity and asking questions, and sometimes those questions are a bit silly. And I think I don't want to be a Darwin bore. I know everyone's been going on about Darwin in the last few weeks, but that's one
we
of
can't
that
have
was
too much Darwin, in my opinion.
Well, it was one of his characteristics was he had an absolutely superb curiosity, and he was actually rather unembarrassed about asking questions that other people would have thought were ridiculous. So, for example, when he was studying sexual attraction between other animals, he pointed out that perhaps the red hinder ends of monkeys were attractive to other monkeys, and he remarked that he was aware that in saying so, he opened himself to ridicule.
But the idea you're saying is that you have to be a bit humble about when it comes to ideas. Sometimes ideas might sound completely stupid, but then they're proved to be correct through experimental.
I think that there are a lot of things that can inhibit our quest for knowledge, and possibly the two most important are internal, and one is talking yourself out of doing the experiment in the first place, and the other is not even asking the question.
So assumptions, essentially.
Yeah,
and you say assumptions. That assumptions are incredibly insidious. Now, can you give us a couple of examples of where that has sort of manifested itself?
I think it's manifested itself all over the place. I mean, in my own field, in evolutionary biology, and in particular in the evolution of sex, it was taken as read for an extremely long time that males were interested in sex and females weren't. And generally across the species, that was believed to be true. And then gradually, more and more DNA data started coming in showing that actually females were having a lot of sex with a lot of different males, and that this was not at all fitting with what people had expected. And I think that it was basically an assumption that females didn't like sex. It tells us more about our society than about the females.
Yeah. Was that a consequence of Darwin's the age that Darwin was working in that he had to maybe he felt pressured to sort of express it that way and so as not to offend?
You mean females not wanting sex?
Yeah.
No, well, that endured until the 1980s.
Right.
I mean, that was an ongoing assumption. In fact, I don't think that Darwin shared it, because Darwin thought that his explanation for things like peacock's tails and indeed the hinder end of monkeys was that females had a sense of beauty, and that they were actively choosing who they were having sex with, whereas many people at the time, and indeed into the 1970s and 80s, thought that females were essentially passive, and males fought over them, and then females just kind of had sex with whoever was around, and they didn't really care.
You gave another interesting example in your comment piece last week, though, which was the Nobel Prize for working out the cause of stomach ulcers, which everyone assumed was something to do with stress, which actually is kind of rather Victorian notion, I think, anyway. But what happened there?
Well, so a couple of Australian scientists in the 1980s, doctors, started looking at stomach ulcers again, and it had been widely assumed that they were due to stress or excess stomach acid or something like that. And they noticed an association with bacteria in the stomach, and it was bacteria that was known to exist. Everyone assumed it was just a harmless commensal. But then one of the scientists decided that he was absolutely convinced that this was the cause of ulcers, and he decided to show it was by drinking some. And he made himself extremely ill, much more ill than, I mean, it was nearly a fatal mistake. But that was actually the moment at which they were started to collect data to show that actually it wasn't just an association, there was a causal relationship.
Maybe that was an experiment he should have taught himself. But I don't know, he wouldn't be a Nobel Prize winner if he had.
I think that's right. I think there's a certain amount of chutzpah among most of the unexpected discoveries. And it, a lot of the time it comes down to sort of having the nerve to do the experiment.
The thing about science is that it is largely about consensus in many respects. Many discoveries are incremental. They sort of build upon something that's happened before. So for something like the discovery about ulcers, it completely changed what people thought. So no one believed these scientists for a very long time. But what they did do is go off and find data and do experiments. And eventually, you know, they persuaded the rest of the world. That kind of stuff, though, does it happen a lot in science, or is it something very rare? Are scientists still a conservative bunch?
I think there's a lot of variation. I think that there's a sociologist of science called Frank Soloway who argues that people who are the oldest in their families tend to be conservative, and they also tend to be sort of successful in traditional ways. So they tend to sort of run banks and do this and do that and the other, and they tend not to be terribly daring, whereas younger children tend to be more daring, more radical. And for example, Darwin was not the oldest in his family. And Soloway did a beautiful graph that showed that people who were oldest children were much less likely to accept Darwin's ideas until about the 1930s, whereas people who were younger, or pretty much all of Darwin's most ardent supporters, were all also not oldest children. And so I think that depending on the ratio of who's doing science when, I think that there is a lot of conservatism, but I think it's also built into the funding process. You know, large amounts of money are being dispensed. People are basically paid to find fault with ideas. And there was Craig Venter, who became famous for his part in sequencing the human genome. He recounts in his autobiography how he published a paper on a way to look at very small pieces of DNA in the cell, or RNA in the cell. And he heard from somebody who had written a grant proposal to do the same thing and had got back a brutal critique, saying it can't possibly work, about a week before Craig published his paper in Science. And so, you know, there's a lot of criticism. I mean, it's an intrinsically critical activity, but that creates conservatism, I think.
How do you weed out people who actually do have crazy ideas? For example, it's all very well to say that, for example, the ulcer story we talked about, that really was a case of they went against the scientific establishment for so long, but they did what good scientists do. They went and experimented, and they relentlessly found data that supported their argument. But there are lots of people always saying, oh, scientists aren't listening to what I'm saying. You know, there's lots of... I've just proved the theory of general relativity.
A lot of them write to me on a regular basis.
I was going to say, a lot of them write to us in pen and paper. And how do you weed out people who genuinely don't know what they're talking about? Or is that actually another risk you need to take?
Well, I think that, you know, it's a balance of probabilities, right? I mean, there are wacky ideas, and the idea that a bacterium living in your stomach makes you ill isn't a terribly wacky idea.
But no one believed him.
I mean, nobody believed him for a long time.
The greatest scientists in the land, if you'd spoken to them at the time, would have said, that's just nonsense. I think the
main thing is that it just sort of, it helps, I think, to from time to time just kind of say, well, what am I taking for granted? How much do we really know?
Olivia, thank you. And now, by the magic of podcasting, we're going to bring you the full version of Olivia's Sense About Science lecture as a science extra later in the week. Check out the web at guardian.co.uk/science, or you can check out our amazing new Twitter feed. That's twitter.com/scienceweekly.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Let's take a look now at some of the other stories around this week.
News Jack.
The word dirty is most in danger of going the way of the dodo and could vanish from use completely within 750 years. According to new research, other words that will lose out in the linguistic fight for survival are likely to be the words guts, throw and stick, which could be permanently displaced by new words within 1,000 years.
NASA's pioneering satellite designed to map carbon dioxide concentrations has crashed into the ocean near Antarctica after running into technical difficulties during launch last week. The orbiting carbon observatory blasted off in the early hours of Tuesday morning, but minutes later, NASA announced the satellite had failed to separate from its launch vehicle.
Scientists may have found a way to regrow rotting teeth. By studying tooth development, they have singled out a gene which controls the growth of enamel, the hard outer layer which cannot grow back naturally once it is damaged by tooth decay. The discovery sheds fresh light on the way teeth form and could pave the way for new dental treatments that heal decayed teeth by regenerating a layer of enamel, making traditional drilling and filling obsolete.
And finally, the next time you're caught doodling in a meeting, simply tell your colleagues that you're just trying to boost your concentration. Rather than being frowned upon, doodling should be actively encouraged in meetings because it improves our ability to pay attention, a British psychologist claims. In experiments, doodlers recalled 29% more names and places from a meeting than a control group supposedly paying attention.
News Jack. Ian, James, thank you very much for that. Let's go into some of those stories a bit more. In the story about words becoming extinct, just take us through how they work this out.
Well, actually, before that, I think there's a word that's going to go extinct before dirty. These guys think dirty is going to go extinct in the next 750 years. I think the word settee is going to go extinct within my lifetime, because I remember my parents using it, and I don't hear it at all anymore.
Say sofa, don't we?
Exactly. Sofa's now the front runner. You know, this is really about how quickly words are replaced in our language, and the actual adherence to evolutionary theory is minor. They looked at the sort of how words get replaced over in the Indo-European languages dating back about 10,000 years. And you find that a couple of rules drop out. First of all, those words, strangely the ones that change most quickly, are those ones which are used less frequently. So I and we and numerals 1, 2, 3, things like that, they are almost unchanged over the entire time. Nouns move very slowly. But if you look at adjectives, adverbs and things, words that you actually used less frequently, they're more likely to be replaced sooner. So they have less of a lifetime.
I don't understand why the word dirty, for example, would go extinct, because it doesn't mean that in the future we're not going to be dirty because of various technologies, or that the word dirty will be replaced for something else.
Well, if you look at dirty, there are about 46 synonyms in the Indo-European languages that are in use at the moment, and that means it's vulnerable for being replaced, apparently, according to these researchers at the University of Reading.
James, are there words that you want to see extinct?
Well, I slightly wanted to take issue with your introduction, because you said the introduction of your story, because you said some of our favourite words might be about is dirty a favourite word of yours?
Dirty's Ian's favourite word.
Yeah.
Really? Oh, okay, fair enough.
It's quite a common word.
I'm more of a fan of blancmange.
I've got two, which are joint top, juggernaut and parallax. But dirty's a good word.
Parallax is a great word.
Parallax is a great word.
Shall I tell you about the satellite?
Sorry, go on.
This was...
The orbiting carbon observatory, yes.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, this was going to be quite an interesting gadget, actually, flying around up there. The idea was to map the sources and sinks of carbon, or at least more precisely, to show the concentration of carbon in different parts of the planet, and therefore infer from that where the sources and sinks were. But unfortunately, it didn't quite make it, because the nose fairing, which is kind of like a nose cone, failed to separate from the satellite. And so because it was heavier than it was supposed to be, it didn't make it into the orbit that it was supposed to, and it crashed into the ocean.
It's a $190 million satellite. And one of the things it was going to do, which it looks like obviously might not happen now, was going to try and solve this mystery of the world's carbon sinks. Now, we know from global climate models that the amount of carbon that's being produced, we also know the amount that's disappearing, and they can account for, is it a third from forests and so on, a third in the sea, but they can't account for the other third. Where is it going? It's going somewhere, but they can't account for where it was going. And this satellite was going to go around the Earth every 16 days and kind of show in real time where these sources and sinks are, and show you where unexpected sinks were turned up. And I think that it's a bit of a shame it's not going to happen. Now, is it likely it's going to get rebuilt?
Oh, I think so. I think it's such an interesting experiment that I'm sure they'll find the money and do it again, but it'll probably take a couple of years. I mean, in the meantime, they've put together an accident investigation board, effectively, to work out what went wrong and, you know, make sure it doesn't happen again.
A Japanese satellite actually went up a couple of weeks ago, which was going to do something similar. It wasn't quite as, I hesitate to say sophisticated, but I mean, it wasn't quite meant to do exactly the same thing in terms of mapping concentrations of CO2 in real time, but it went up, and that's up there now. So it's not that the scientists won't have this data. It'll be slightly different.
I think this ties in a bit with what you were saying in your comment piece, Olivia, because this is an example of a new piece of technology, a new tool that allows you to answer questions that weren't possible before. And one of the things you were saying in your piece was that there are large boundaries between knowledge and ignorance, and those areas where the front is moving fastest is where suddenly we have the tools to answer questions that we want to answer.
Well, absolutely, and I think that having new ways of looking at the planet, whether it's by new genome sequencing, new telescopes, new satellites, whatever it is, new submarines to go and look at the ocean floor, just looking is a big start to being able to ask more questions and make predictions.
I have to know about this doodling, though. Well, what?
I was going to say, is that about? Do you doodle in meetings? Do you doodle all day, probably, don't you, Ian?
No, stories? I'm not really good at doodling because they're sort of two responses.
Or concentrating.
Either you don't like what's coming out, because you just wonder what on earth that says about me. But they're usually fairly bad doodles. I can't draw for my life, so I don't doodle
very
much.
But a doodle's not a form, it's not meant to be a sort of a Picasso.
No, but I think there's.
I think Ian just judges himself very hardly.
You get critical of your doodles.
Absolutely, yeah. And I
this
try
man
not to
sets
do
high standards for himself.
I try not to do geometric things because then you think I'm sort of feels clearly sort of on some sort of spectrum, and I don't know. I just think I don't enjoy.
Tell us about the.
Let me tell you about the study.
Research, yes. Go on.
The interesting thing about this is it's probably not actually that doodling is good for your concentration, but that if you're not paying attention, then when you're daydreaming, that's very bad for your attention. So picture the scene, you're in a boring meeting. It's quite easy for us to do it here.
Right now, yeah.
If your mind is wandering off to what you're going to have for dinner or where you're going to go on holiday, and you start thinking about, well, I'm probably going to get flights to here and here, and this is what this city is like that I'll land in, then I'll tootle off to this village, and all of this stuff's going to happen. The research behind this thinks that is actually sort of more cognitively demanding than if you're just doing some very repetitive basic thing, which is just about holding your attention but locking you into actually what you're supposed to be doing, rather than going off on this wild flight of fancy in your mind.
So it sort of
mind.
Keeps you in the room. Was there an experiment, though, to back this up? Or?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't just sort of a stating, but I mean, there are issues with the experiment. What I was saying to the researcher is, well, if you were one of these people who does these enormously elaborate sort of multifaceted doodles, then maybe that is actually really indulgent and your mind would be way off what you are supposed to be listening to. And I've been in meetings where people look completely absorbed in the doodles they're doing, so I'm a bit iffy about it.
Well, I don't know. It occupies a different part of the brain.
True.
Drawing and language are completely different parts of the brain, and it's much easier to do two different things like that at the same time than it is to have two conversations at once or deal with two kinds of text at once to read and to be listening to a conversation. That's much harder.
Right, we're going to stop talking about this before our listeners doodle away. For more on this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science, and you can get a feed of all of our stories at twitter.com/guardianscience. Now, before we wind up this section, I'm going to remind our listeners to check out Tim Radford's post on the Science website. We're starting up an online book club there. The first book we're going to talk about is Life, an Unauthorized Biography by Richard Forty. Tim says it is steeped in the scientific revolution launched by Darwin, incorporating the great early science that preceded and influenced Darwin. But it has another virtue. As the first text for a new book club, he says, it's unashamedly literary. So get reading the book, and the discussions are going to open up on March the 9th at the Science blog. Please also post any comments you have on the Facebook wall or leave the message on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now, we've left questions of existence in philosophy alone for a while now, but we'll dip back just for a moment. The physicist John Polkinghorne is, some would argue, a controversial figure amongst scientists. His scientific work was on the theories of elementary particles, and he played a significant role in the discovery of the quark. But in 1979, he left physics to become an Anglican priest, and he's since published books on the subject of religion and science. He's got a new book out called Questions of Truth, which poses answers to questions such as, can you prove God exists, and is he actually a delusion? Ian, you spoke to him. What was he like?
He was really interesting, actually, and took all the questions I put to him really, really well, I think, because I found a lot of his beliefs truly baffling. So it was really interesting to have some time with him. So why have you written this book now, and what are you setting out to do with it?
Well, the book has arisen out of a website that Nicholas Beale has run about me for about 10 years, which is an interactive site. And people ask questions, and Nick and I seek to produce answers to them. And our purpose is to show people that there are motivations for religious belief. Religious belief isn't just a question of shutting your eyes and believing impossible things because some unquestionable authority tells you. There are reasons for it, and we want to share our reasons with the people who inquire. And we thought, after doing this for 10 years, we could make an interesting book out of some of the most leading questions.
Now, you were a quantum physicist, and one thing that struck me that quantum physics and religion have in common is a taste for seemingly crazy ideas. In quantum theory, you can have particles can be in two places at once and even appear out of nowhere. And in religion, you can have these sort of all-knowing, invisible super beings. I mean, do you see there as being common ground between them? Do you think these ideas appeal to similar mindsets?
Well, I think if physics teaches you anything, it teaches you the world is surprising. As you say, things can be both here and there, which sounds ridiculous. So therefore, we are prepared to realize that the world is different from the way common sense sees it. So the natural question for a physicist to ask, either in science or in fact religion, is not is it reasonable, as if you knew beforehand the shape the reason had to take. It isn't reasonable something should be both here and there. But we ask a different question, in one sense more open, in another sense more demanding. What makes you think that might be the case? In other words, what you are going to suggest to us may be very surprising and strange and unexpected, but we won't believe it unless you have motivating evidence for it. And I'm quite prepared to, in fact, welcome approaching my religious beliefs in that same spirit as I approach my scientific beliefs.
Well, this is something I was going to go on to next, really. I mean, in the scientific view of the world, at the very least, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. But in religion, it kind of demands belief in some quite outlandish ideas in the absence of any proof. And how do you square that as a former scientist? Does your scientific mind not have to take a back seat?
Not at all. I certainly don't switch my mind off when I think about religion. I object to the word outlandish. They may be strange and surprising. But that's a different matter. There are motivations of those beliefs. I mean, there are two sorts of motivations, really. One is just the nature of the world. Science finds a world that is wonderfully ordered, amazingly fruitful. A ball of energy is turned into the home of saints and scientists. Are these all things just happy accidents, or are they the sign that a deeper mind and a deeper purpose lies behind what's going on in the world, and belief in God answers those questions positively? And then, of course, I'm a Christian, and so my Christian beliefs center really on my encounter with the figure of Jesus Christ, as I believe I meet him in the New Testament, in the church, and in fact in the sacraments. So there's motivating evidence. We don't talk about proof, actually, either in science or in religion. We talk about well-motivated beliefs. We commit ourselves to them, but we know that we don't know everything about everything that we would like to know.
What do you think will happen to you when you die?
Well, I believe that death is a real thing, but I don't think it is the ultimate end, because I think only God is ultimate. And I think I shall have a destiny beyond death. It's obviously hard to imagine in detail. Wait and see is the best answer to that question in one sense. But I think that in the world to come, God will be progressively unveiled, and we'll be drawn more and more into the divine reality, and our lives will be transformed. And heaven is going to be interesting. It isn't sitting on a cloud strumming a harp and shouting hallelujah all the time. It will be the endless exploration of the inexhaustible riches of the divine nature. So I think it's a remarkable destiny lies ahead of us.
But you think your body will decompose?
Oh, of course my body will decompose.
And so,
but I also think it's intrinsic to human beings that we do have a body. And that's why I very much accept the Christian hope of resurrection. It isn't a sort of spiritual survival, a sort of ghostly bit of me floating along. We're not apprentice angels. We're embodied beings. Our bodies will die and so on, but God will not allow us, the real me, to be forgotten. And God will, I believe, in an unimaginable but true act of resurrection, re-embody me in a new form of matter, so to speak, in quotation marks, which will be different from the matter of this world. The matter of this world is endowed with futility because it's a world of evolving process, and in evolution, the death of one generation is the necessary cost of a new life of the next. But the world to come will be different from that because it will be a different stage in God's creative purposes.
What's your view on the debate which sort of seems to come and go about the teaching of creationism or maybe more accurately sort of intelligent design on the science curriculum?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the science curriculum ought to teach Darwinian evolution. I mean, it may not be the total explanation of the history of life, but it is a very, very important part of the of understanding the diversity of living beings, and that's what science is about, and widely accepted and well supported scientific theories of what should be taught in the scientific classroom. Outside the scientific classroom, in rigid studies periods or whatever it may be, it is perfectly legitimate to explore other ways of understanding this, deeper ways of understanding it. Is there something going on in what is happening, so to speak, which is a religious question. As far as intelligent design is concerned, I think they make two mistakes. They make a scientific mistake. They haven't proved the irreducible complexity of these little molecular engines that they talk about. But more importantly, they make a theological mistake. Because behind it, they don't say this, but it's clear that behind it is the idea that if nature did it, somehow God didn't have a hand in it. And that's absurd to me. I believe that God is the creator, the ordainer, and sustainer of nature. And God acts as much through natural processes as in any other way. So I have no difficulty whatsoever in holding together a firm scientific belief in the evolutionary process and also my Christian faith.
John Polkinghorne there talking to Ian Sample. I think anyone listening to this podcast for any length of time probably knows what we're going to say or we think. So let's try and avoid any unnecessary criticisms of these things. But one thing I find difficult in listening to that interview was he criticised intelligent design rightly, but then switched off that critical faculty for the rest of the stuff. I don't know, Olivia, how do you feel about things like that? I mean, lots of scientists do have faith and...
They tend to be physicists.
Is it just not done in biology?
There's certainly some religious biologists, but so there have been studies done of religious faith by scientific occupation, and physicists are much more likely to believe in God than biologists.
Is that because their subject is just weirder?
Well, I think probably, yeah. They're sort of staring out into the cosmos, and it's it becomes increasingly incomprehensible. But it's interesting, I think, the nature of religious belief. The Mayans, for example, didn't really do science as we understand it, but they had very sophisticated astronomy, and they predicted the end of the present incarnation of the universe will happen on the 24th of December in 2011. So we'll soon be finding out whether the Mayans were right.
Okay. More than John Polkinghorne's book Questions of Truth is out on Monday, and if you're in London tonight, actually you'll be able to hear him speak at the Royal Society. Well, that's it for this week's Science Weekly. Thanks to my guests Olivia Judson, James Randerson and Ian Sample. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, and do check out those Twitter feeds I mentioned before. We're very excited about those, Guardian Science and Science Weekly. The podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.